preliminary questions or issues?
Okay. Wednesday we left off on the verge of doing the elevator case here on page 35. And this is a more direct application of these general principles of res ipsa loquitur. Ms. Nozaki, can you tell us about Murphy? Okay, what did the plaintiff want that she didn't get? Okay, so she wanted the judge to instruct the jury on res ipsa, and the judge refused. What was the, first of all, just by way of review here, what does a plaintiff need to show to be entitled to a res ipsa instruction? Well, but we're using res ipsa to try to prove that. And in order to have a res ipsa case, a res ipsa case has certain characteristics the plaintiff has to show this case meets to get that instruction. What are the elements of a res ipsa case? The characteristics that need to be shown? Yes, sir. Okay, so element one here would be that this accident falls into a general category of cases where we say, gee, accidents like this typically don't happen unless there's been negligence. Is that, what's the type of accident that occurred here or the phenomenon that caused the accident? What's the accident causing or the injury causing event here? But what specifically happened that caused her to be injured? Right, this misleveling of the elevator. So we're trying to figure out, do elevators normally mislevel just on their own? Or when an elevator mislevels, is that typically the result of somebody's failure to maintain it properly, or they dropped a screwdriver on the, you know, mechanism, or is this usually a result of negligence? What do we know about elevators misleveling? At least according to the plaintiff. Liebman? Who says? Right. So the plaintiff, knowing the plaintiff has to meet this standard, goes out and finds an expert. The expert says, sworn in and says, I'm an expert on elevators, and in my professional judgment, things like this don't ordinarily happen unless somebody's been negligent. So far, so good. That is, if that were the only criterion, we'd be looking pretty good from a res ipsa standpoint. What's the second element of a res ipsa case? Okay. And again, we talked about the way in which exclusive might be a somewhat misleading term, that is, for purposes of this particular case, in terms of the negligence that, not in terms of the negligence, in terms of the injury-producing event, did the defendant have control over the process where we think the negligence took place? Now, on that point, what is the plaintiff's evidence? What does the plaintiff say with respect to the defendant, that is the elevator company's exclusive control over the elevator? Right. When anything major goes on with the elevator, it's somebody with, you know, this, hi, I'm Bill, I'm from Murphy, or from Montgomery Elevator Company here, you know, Maytag repairman, whatever. They're the people that do all the stuff to fix the elevator. So says the plaintiff. What does the defendant say? And Humana again is? Yeah, they're the hospital where this elevator is located. So the defendant says, wait a minute, before you blame everything on us, consider the fact that the hospital has a significant amount of influence here, or they do stuff with the elevator. Minor things that go wrong, they will fix. They call us in for the big, you know, elevator overhaul, or if the thing gets stuck and they don't know how to fix it, but it's sort of like a copy machine, you know, if there's paper jammed in the copy machine, even I know how to, you know, reach in there and pull the stuff out and, you know, reset the thing if I can't fix it, I'll call the copy repair people, but it's not like everything that goes wrong with a copy machine, we know the only person who ever had anything to do with it is the copy machine repair people. Similarly, in this case, they say the hospital had a significant amount of control, participation in the repair and maintenance of this elevator. What does the judge say on that point again? You've already told me this, but just to refresh our memory, the trial judge, when he heard this evidence, said what? Right. Plaintiff, you're not cutting the mustard here. You want a res ipsa loquitur instruction, but you haven't satisfied this three-part test here. You haven't shown that the defendant had exclusive control. And on that point, obviously, the plaintiff is appealing and saying that the evidence was sufficient to show that the elevator company had exclusive control. What does the appeals court say? Pardon? Right. They affirmed the trial court. That is, the trial judge did not make a mistake by refusing to instruct the jury on res ipsa, and therefore, when the jury listened to the evidence and didn't hear any evidence of negligence, at least it didn't satisfy them, and the plaintiff was denied the use of this inference that from the happening of the accident itself, the plaintiff wanted the jury to be able to infer negligence, and the trial judge didn't tell them to do that. And again, the appellate court said, that's fine, you did just the right thing. We're now left with the plaintiff losing. So, again, it's just a little application of this general principle. You could have had a case in which the third element was missing, or the evidence wasn't strong enough on the first element, but it's just another kind of classic illustration that you have a general principle, but you see it put into practice here. Any questions about res ipsa or about this particular case? Okay. Well, moving right along then, we have basically the last of our, you know, sort of adding tools to our tool belt here. We've had industry custom and jury experience and statutory violations and res ipsa. Now we come to this idea of using the defendant's own policies or actions to establish the standard of care. Ms. Bissell, can you tell us about Smith? Okay, and so the defendant's appealing this judgment, and among other assignments of error, what's the defendant complaining about in this case? I'm sorry, say that again. In the appeal, Walmart's complaining about what? Go ahead. As I said before, Walmart's complaining about a bunch of different things, but the one we're focusing on for purposes of this little section of Chapter 1 is... Well, that's actually one of her many arguments, one of Walmart's many arguments, but... We'd have to wait for Chapter 5 to look at the contributory negligence issue. On this point, it's the question of using the evidence of what they did after the accident that's at issue. So as part of the testimony of what happened, the jury is allowed to hear that after she fell down, they went and got mats and to put them in the area that was where the floor was slippery. Now, this falls under the general category. There are actually two different names for this same concept, but different names. One is the idea of post-accident repairs. The other name that's given for this is subsequent remedial measures. And again, the idea is that after the accident, the defendant does something which the plaintiff then wants to point to and say, aha, this was something that you should have done before the accident, and this proves that you were negligent. What's the general rule about whether the plaintiff may or may not use such evidence? Okay, but the general rule that we start with, sort of before we get to exception for the rule, would be, yeah, okay. So we start with the principle that this is, whatever you call it, these are inadmissible So again, we start with a presumption that Walmart is entitled to complain that this evidence was used to establish their negligence. However, despite this general rule, we have exceptions to the rule. And what are those exceptions? When can you use it? Go ahead. Okay, and before we get to these exceptions, it's worthwhile to recognize that the only way the plaintiff gets to use one of these exceptions is where the defendant has essentially set it up. That is, the plaintiff can't on their own wake up and say, hey, I want to use this evidence to prove ownership. The defendant has to first contest ownership such that, okay, now that's an issue. If, for example, in this case, well, there isn't any issue about ownership. It happened at a Walmart. But let's suppose you were talking about a store that was in a shopping center where you had a parking lot like, you know, at Northtown or better yet, at a place like, I can't think of a, maybe someplace downtown where you have a bunch of different stores kind of clustered around a common area. And the plaintiff slips and falls, and when the plaintiff goes to sue the store owner, the store says, wait a minute, she fell in a part of the property that's not our responsibility. That was the responsibility of the store next door, or it's the land, you know, the mall owner's responsibility. We're not responsible for the maintenance of the particular area where she fell. Well, if the defendant challenges ownership, if it is to prove ownership or control, and the defendant has put this in issue, well, then the plaintiff can use it. Okay, another way in which the defendant can raise an issue that will allow the use of this post-accident repair step. Another exception to the rule that it's inadmissible, you can offer this evidence to prove something else besides ownership or control. Yes? Feasibility. Again, if the defendant says, oh, we couldn't use mats, then the automatic door opener wouldn't work, or you know, mats would cause people to trip over the mats themselves. You can't accuse us of being negligent for failing to use that. That is not a feasible solution to the problem. Well, again, if the defendant challenges the plaintiff's proposed safety measure by saying, that was not feasible, the plaintiff can come back and use a post-accident repair to say, well, you claim it wasn't feasible, but look, you've used that very measure. So again, if it's being offered to use feasibility in both of these, essentially, if challenged, well, that's an exception to our general rule of inadmissibility. While we're at it, do either of these things apply to Walmart? No. So we're dependent on this last one to see if there's any validity to the admissibility. What's the final exception to excluding this kind of evidence? Yeah. Yeah. And more, impeachment would fall under a slightly larger heading of essentially that the defendant opened the door. We have this expression, particularly in criminal cases where, for example, the defendant's criminal past is ordinarily not something the prosecution can use as evidence of the claim that the defendant committed the crime. You know, if somebody's on trial for burglary, I can't, as a prosecutor, show they already have 8 convictions for burglary. However, if the defendant raises the issue of the defendant's character by bringing in a string of witnesses who say, wonderful kid, never been in trouble, you know, completely out of character, couldn't be this guy. Well, then the defendant has opened the door to evidence to impeach the defendant's character. So again, the idea of impeachment as a way of addressing an issue which the defendant has raised. Is that doctrine applicable to this case? There's some suggestion here that the defendant's own manager, I think, made reference to the mats here. Yeah, I can't remember where it is. Yeah, right. So somebody wasn't, you know, they weren't all in the same playbook here, which... trial lawyers discover sometimes to their great consternation, thinking that everybody understands what the way we're going to handle this, and some witness not having listened when you went through the playbook of how we're going to do this, this witness goes off, sailing off in a direction, and there goes the neighborhood. Yeah. Right. Both things would come into play here. We have both the problem that the defendant's own witness starts talking about these floor mats. So rather than being able to say it's the plaintiff's fault that this evidence came in, we say it's the defendant's. But there's also this idea of acquiescence going back as far as the turntable case, that where the defendant has failed to object to something, has allowed something to go on, you can't start complaining about it in the appellate court. So again, the defendant on both counts, both by allowing their witness to start talking about it in the first place and then not seeking some kind of restorative order, so that if your witness inadvertently says something they're not supposed to say, you can ask the judge, please tell the jury to disregard that. People sometimes are skeptical of the jury's ability, as the expression goes. Lawyers often seek a mistrial, arguing that you can't unring the bell, that once the jury has heard certain kinds of testimony, they're incapable of sort of pressing the delete button. They will inevitably be affected by it, even if they have been told not to rely on something or not to consider it in their deliberation. But the defendant didn't even try in this case to exclude that evidence, but simply let it go through. So again, the trial court looks at all of this evidence and says, defendant has nothing to complain about in terms of it coming in. Could the defendant have kept it out? Yeah, because again, the general rule is that if the plaintiff seeks to introduce that sort of evidence to prove negligence, the general rule is no, you can't rely on that. Why? What's the reason for restricting the plaintiff's ability to use evidence, which seems like a pretty common sense kind of point of view? Yeah. Ms. Bissell? Yeah. Okay. It would have this perverse incentive, or it would have an undesirable disincentive. Instead of people reacting after an accident by doing things to avoid such accidents in the future, their lawyers would be telling them, don't do that, it makes you look bad. So to avoid that kind of disincentive, we make sure that actions like this after an accident are excluded from what the jury will be told. Okay, so we have this one fairly clear rule about the use of post-accident repairs. You may not see the connection, but I'm sort of, just to be difficult, asking you to look at the next case, Stevens' case, and ask the question of whether or not there is a similarity between the two. Mr. McElvin. Malpractice? Not necessarily. I mean, for one thing, I think you would have to show, if you're going to hold the lawyer accountable in a malpractice action, you'd have to show that this tipped the balance, that if they had been able to keep this evidence out, that Walmart could have avoided the verdict against them. It would be pretty hard to show that the jury in this case made their decision on that basis. It certainly didn't help, but unlike the Mariners' inability to advance a runner from third with only one out, it's a lot harder to tell what exact difference it made that you got this evidence in when you could have kept it out. Legal malpractice cases tend to be filed less on judgment calls. It's pretty rare for a lawyer's judgment, even if the judgment is very questionable, the judgment to take a settlement or not to take a settlement. Most legal malpractice cases revolve around very clear, running of stop signs or blowing a statute of limitations or failing to disclose a conflict of interest or something else where the rule is very clear and the violation of the rule is very clear. Trying to show that a judgment call was a bad judgment, even though 9 lawyers out of 10 would agree, gee, that was a really dumb idea, cases like that are much less common. And also in the heat of trial, a lot of stuff happens that wasn't exactly, if I had been able to map all this out, I would have done things differently. It's actually one of trying cases is, when you see it on TV and you see the lawyers making their closing arguments to the jury or this dramatic, cross-examination of the witness, they're all doing it without notes and so on. If you actually watch court TV with a much more boring process of examining witnesses and so forth, the real life cases, they're usually too boring even to show on court TV. But one of the difficult things in trying cases is that you have to have you have to sort of be multitasking. If you're, for example, doing the direct examination of a witness, you have to remember what your series of questions is. You have to be listening to the witness giving you the answer. You have to be recognizing if there's some kind of discrepancy, but you also have to be monitoring what's the jury's. Is the jury interested in this? Are they getting bored? And then you get objections. So, the objection, that evidence is. Then you have to think about what's the rule of law and the exception to the hearsay rule and keeping an eye on the judge. You're basically, you don't have enough, you've got a Pentium 2 when what you really need is a Pentium 4 to just process all the stuff that's going on. So it's the kinds of things that happen in trial are often not ones that you would have done if you had it to do all over again. And this is one of the just got lost in the shuffle. The lawyer's probably thinking about something else, doesn't quite realize what's going on. Gee, that's a subsequent remedial measure. That's not admissible. And you're thinking about six other things, which you have to do at the same time. Okay, Stevens. Ms. Dennis, can you tell us about Stevens? Okay, so the question is, can you use the defendant's safety policy, that is, the employer telling the trolley car operators, make sure you ring the gong as you approach an intersection, is the defendant's or the employee's failure to do that admissible evidence of negligence? Yeah, you're nodding your head yes, and you're right. It is admissible. But now, just to be difficult, why doesn't this fall within the same general principle that we talked about in the previous case, namely that to the extent that you, in effect, punish defendants because they've tried to do the right thing, isn't that kind of unfair and bad social policy? Won't the effect be that employers will rip up their rule books, which would make us worse off instead of better off? No, why not? What's the distinction between this case and the previous case? Why is it admissible in this case, but generally inadmissible in cases involving post-accident repairs? First of all, what distinction can you draw between the two cases, just fact or on a sort of superficial level? One involved Walmart, one involved a trolley, but what's the distinction? What other distinctions could you draw to say, well, it applies here, but it doesn't apply there? Yeah, and this, just to kind of make a long story short, you could, I think, debate the wisdom of making this distinction. But the fact is the courts do make the distinction between pre-accident safety policies, what I would call, the shorthand that I use for these is a rule book violation. Where the employer has a rule book, it doesn't need to actually be written down, but the equivalent of a rule book, a standard way of doing things, even if it's something that's essentially adopted by the employees themselves, it's almost sort of like a little mini industry custom. They've figured out the smart way to do things, and they have a custom of, gee, when you do this, this is the way you do it. An employee's failure to abide by that standard is admissible. But everything changes if you're talking about a policy or a practice or a repair adopted after the accident. That is viewed as being irrelevant to the question of whether it was negligent at the time and this worry about the public policy effect of such a rule makes such repairs or policies inadmissible. Now, again, you could be concerned that a policy like this would discourage employers from adopting a rule book. But give me an example of a rule that you would adopt. Let's say you run a grocery store business, you're Safeway, and you have truck drivers who carry your groceries from the warehouse to the retail stores. Tell me things you would put in your rule book, despite the fact the things in your rule book are going to be used against you at trial. You're Safeway, you're talking to your truck drivers, you're writing up the employee rule book. Give me a rule that you would put in that rule book. Yes, sir. Okay. That's actually one that I think would be more debatable. There's one rule you would, or several rules you would clearly have, Mr. Tucker. There's something a little more basic, Ms. Rush. Yeah, okay. Obey the law, you know, or drive sober. Can we start there? A rule book containing rules that it's not as though, gee, we were afraid that people would hold this rule book against us, you know, so we left out the part. We were hoping that in the absence of telling our drivers to drive sober, that the jury wouldn't hang them for failing. Well, look, you know, if they drive drunk, they're going to be in trouble anyway. It's not like we're hanging out a lot because we put this in. On the other hand, if there were a rule that says drive 10 miles an hour below the speed limit for trucks, some places there are different speed limits for cars than there are for trucks, but if I make a rule that says drive 10 miles an hour below the speed limit, I really am setting myself up, I think, for trouble there, because if my truck driver is driving the speed limit, but the rule book says drive 10 miles an hour below the speed limit, that can be used against me. Quite frankly, if I'm safe, I'll be happy if my guys are driving the speed limit, because very often they don't. But the question of whether I put that in my rule book, drive the speed limit, stop at way stations, be a courteous driver, those things are in effect already required by law. It doesn't hurt me to put them in the rule book, and it serves as a basis for me in disciplining my employees, and maybe by putting it in the rule book that they have to drive the speed limit, I will reduce their incentive to drive above the speed limit, because as it turns out, in many cases, they're trying to make up time. They're behind schedule, and they're supposed to be at a certain place before it closes or whatever, and so they are already tempted to drive above the speed limit, and as the employer, I don't want them to. I don't want them taking three martini lunches, and then getting in their trucks and driving above the speed limit. So it may be that there is some disincentive at the margin for those kinds of rules that would be thought of as kind of extra. I would like my drivers to, be courteous on the road, more than courteous to, if you see somebody if you observe an automobile accident, go try to provide them with first aid. Maybe that's something I want them to do, but I would hesitate writing that into the rule book for fear the rule book would start showing up as evidence that we were not living up to our own standards. And in the absence of that rule, I could say, gee, we didn't have any obligation to do that, but if I stick it in my rule book, suddenly I'm held to that higher standard. Mr. Johnson? Well, if you have caused an injury, and then afterward, I mean, I when I was thinking about stopping, you know, after an accident, I'm not referring to an accident caused by the truck. I'm thinking the truck driver is going down the road half a mile up ahead, somebody spins out and hits a tree, and then he pulls over to see if he can render first aid, as opposed to, by law, if you are involved in an accident, you do have to get out deal with the consequences of that. So I was thinking more along the lines of something that was above and beyond the call of duty, where, again, there would be some disincentive to trim the rule book down to kind of the bare minimum, as opposed to having the rule book go into a bunch of other admirable things, but would wind up being held against us. That is not the case with subsequent remedial measures. In fact, oftentimes you do, as the expression goes, close the barn door after the horse is gone. If there is an uncontrolled, you know, blind intersection and some little kid gets run over on a bicycle, there may very well be pressure to go put a stop sign in, and people saying, gee, this is a terribly dangerous intersection, we need to have a stop sign, and maybe the city or somebody will come and put a stop sign in to make people feel better. But again, that subsequent remedial measure is ordinarily protected from being used as proof that they should have had one before the accident. Okay, questions about, again, the law in this area is quite clear. I've been difficult in terms of questioning whether or not it's the distinction is a compelling one, but it's a clear one. Post-accident repairs, inadmissible pre-accident safety policies, rule book violations are all fair game. We just have a little more time left. Our next section here on vicarious liability, I suppose we can get started here a little bit. We'll see. Let me just make some general comments. Yeah. Good question. Right, right. Well, it's a good, you know, has the defendant argued the feasibility issue, or have they, in effect, opened the door such that you can legitimately impeach them? Those are the sorts of things where, again, how far the door has to be opened before it's open is a judgment call for the trial judge. But, this might be an illustration of the sort of exam principle that for purposes of your preparation for the exam, once you have the rule in mind that here's the general rule, evidence is inadmissible unless it's offered to show ownership or feasibility or to impeach something where the defendant's opened the door. Once you have the rule in mind, then if you get a question that seems to be, gee, that's sort of right in the middle there, I'm not sure whether that would really qualify as evidence of feasibility or not. You're perfectly situated on the exam essentially to say, I don't know how this one would turn out. Certainly the plaintiff would argue that it did constitute evidence of feasibility and would therefore make this admissible. The defendant would say, no, it falls short of that. And, gosh, I don't know what the answer is. So to the extent, again, that you have the rule clearly in mind and it's the application of the rule where you're somewhat doubtful, that's, lots of exam questions are made up precisely along those lines to give you something on the margin so that you have an opportunity to say, well, here's the rule, and these are the arguments on both sides. Here's the evidence that favors this point of view. Here's the evidence that would favor the opposite. Okay. We've now completed this section of chapter one that addresses, again, kind of getting your vice grips and your screwdriver and your crescent wrench and your soldering iron all, you know, loaded up here, and you're ready to rumble. We now shift to a different kind of issue here, of assuming I can establish that, so to speak, the little guy is negligent. How do I pin this on the big guy, the deep pocket? How do I make sure that I'm not left with a judgment against, you know, some guy in a, hi, I'm Bill, I'm from the elevator company. I don't want the keys to his rusty 94 Honda Accord. I want the insurance company, I want the employer to pay for this. Now, sometimes people have the mistaken impression that vicarious liability is by itself a form of, it's like strict liability or negligence, you know, but it doesn't fit into that category. It by itself is not a way of showing that somebody deserves to pay for it. It's, or at least, it's a way of starting with somebody else who's supposed to pay for it and extending that principle through the concept of what we call agency. There's actually a whole body of law. In fact, there's a restatement of agency alongside the restatement of property, the restatement of contract, restatement of torts. There's a restatement of agency. It's a sort of doctrine, body of doctrine and body of law. And you covered in some detail in your business associations class, where you talk about corporations and partnerships, the whole area of how do I establish that when the sales representative made this offer to me, that I can hold the company to that. The company can't say, no, we never authorized that. He didn't have the authority to make that kind of a deal. So again, the sort of larger question of when can we make somebody, in the law of agency, it refers to the relationship between principal and agent. Principal is the deep pocket, typically. The agent is the, you know, sales representative or the employee who the plaintiff wants to link up to the principal to tap the principal's deeper pockets. Now, in our context, we'll be dealing with employer-employee, or sometimes referred to as master-servant, the older terminology, again, where you have some negligent act by the employee and you're trying to establish the liability of the employer. Ms. Rush? Okay. I'm guessing that Far West Services is the drinking establishment. I usually like to start Monday with a drunken lawyer case, but it doesn't look like we're going to get there today. We'll start there tomorrow, but I'm guessing that they were one of the defendants for over-serving this officer of the court here. But this particular case, obviously, is the appeal from the summary judgment with regard to the law firm. So we'll pick up with dispute resolution in the parking lot. Talk about that tomorrow. Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. Right. Yeah. And I could. I haven't talked to Gordon about that, but whatever he has that he wants to post, I could easily put it there. What's that? Oh, well, that's an idiom. Actually, they're etymologically complex. Some people think it's to cut the muster. You know, like you muster a bunch of troops, and you know, you decide who's called and who isn't. But I think the ultimate cut the mustard was, you know, sort of a cooking idea. But the idiom is essentially make the grade. It's another would be. So yeah, the plaintiff fell short of establishing res ipsa. Yeah.
Checkbook.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great. Okay, super. So you got one I can give you. In fact, I brought it here. You make one out to me, and I'll give you your check. Right? Just David DeWolf. Yeah, W-O-L-F. Perfect. Great. Perfect.
On there,
this no. My bank will cash it. That's no problem. Great.
Can I say something?
Sure.
Test this to make sure I understand this
correctly. Yeah.
The general rule is that post-incident repairs cannot be used to mm-hmm. establish negligence mm-hmm. because it happened after the fact, and they didn't necessarily know that they were being negligent.
No. The rationale for it is we're worried about the perverse policy effect.
That's the only reason.
Yeah.
It's not because we don't know that they were negligent.
In fact, it's very logical and very compelling to think that their subsequent behavior is an admission of guilt. I mean, it's actually very logical. That's why juries would fail.
Show that at the time. That, okay, I see. Yeah. All right. I'm thinking.
So yeah, you bet. Oh yeah. Oh no, actually. I forgot yours today.
Oh,
But you need a name tag? No. Okay. Sorry. No, I'm sorry. I screw that up. I'll bring it to you tomorrow.
Yeah, and I just got to go to the rep. Basically, it's you don't have to have evidence. You just like fall down somewhere and then you just sue the company. As long as you can prove that, like, those three things.
Tell me under what theory that?
The theory that they was about that they lacked.
Res ipsa, yeah. Res ipsa establishes in those cases where you don't actually have any evidence, but you can infer somebody was negligent.
So yeah, I got the point.
Okay. Yeah.
Point 1, 2, and 3 only come up if it is contested by.
Well, if the defendant has put one of these things in play. Right, exactly.
Or they say, look, it was impossible.
Right,
for us to
right.
Put
right. Right.
Okay. All right.
Just let me do this.